Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. Your host is Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, millions of wild animals are killed each year in the name of handbags, pets, and laboratory specimens. We'll explore the illegal trade in endangered species. Molly Beattie, former head of the Fish and Wildlife Service, recently succumbed to cancer. We remember her dedication to the protection of all of the diversity of life. Increasingly, lumber you see today is labeled as environmentally friendly. We'll look into these claims and tell you which ones you can trust. And we'll dodge flaming chunks of rock while skiing in New Zealand. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Of all illegally traded goods, endangered species and threatened species are, in terms of money, second only to the drug trade. More money is made illegally trading species than by trading illegal weapons. The damage done to animal and plant populations, as well as the ecosystems in which they live, is tremendous. Environment Show producer Thomas Lally has this report.
In recent years, coats made from young seals and other animals have fallen out of fashion, since those who wear them sometimes face the ire of animal rights activists and others. But the killing of seals is one tiny instance where a species, be it animal or plant, is harvested from the wild for human purposes.
Most people don't realize how much the wildlife trade, which is animals and plants, is something that they can and do see every day. Not all trade is illegal, not all trade is harmful to the species at all. But whether it's plants or animals, the U.S. is the world's largest importer of wild animals and plants from around the world. You can go into any major department store and see the wildlife trade, see species from all over the world.
Susan Lieberman heads the CITES operation branch of the Management Authority of the Fish and Wildlife Service. She oversees how laws pertaining to wildlife are enforced and implemented. Perhaps her strongest tool is a law called CITES, which stands for the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wild Flora and Fauna. It's an agreement between countries that regulates the trade, trapping, and treatment of wild plants and animals. Dr. Charles Munn is a senior conservation zoologist with the Wildlife Conservation Society. He works in the Amazon studying macaws and says that poaching can reduce a species population in a very short amount of time.
It's amazing what damage a few organized and sort of non-committed to local management sort of people out there scouring for collectors and traders. They can do incredible damage. There are large reserves around the Iguazu Falls, for instance, in southeastern Brazil, on the Argentinian border, spectacular national parks on both sides of the border that are in excess of 300,000 acres. And that area could easily support thousands of green-winged macaws. They used to live down there, and yet they went extinct there in the late 50s, early 60s because of trapping for local demand as pets.
While the trade in endangered bears, elephants, tigers, and other mammals gets most of the attention, there are plants and even insects that are equally devastated by poaching. Ted Williams reported in Audubon magazine about an international ring of trading in butterflies. Some species brought up to $500 a piece. He says many people wouldn't assume that butterflies could be threatened by trapping.
A lot of collecting can knock them down and eliminate them. In fact, the Mitchell Satyr is thought to be eliminated from New Jersey by over-collecting. And some of these guys are going in there, and if they get $300, $400, $500 a specimen, they're going to wipe out the adults.
Williams says the investigations revealed a global network of people who were willing to pay big money for endangered butterflies. He says the traders often never believe they would be caught.
Their correspondence is very incriminating. They sign some letters, yours in poaching, yours in mass murder, that kind of thing. And I think when this happened, it set an example. The message is out there. Unfortunately, the reaction of a lot of eminent scientists is similar to some of the reactions I've found with the mammal busts on endangered mammals. Instead of being contrite about this and trying to clean up their act, they're blaming the Fish and Wildlife Service for overzealous enforcement.
But most of the trade in species is not this sinister. Many people legally own animals like snakes, iguanas, and parakeets. And most people who do violate the law do so unintentionally, never intending to contribute to the disappearance of endangered plants and animals. The problem, Dr. Munn says, is ignorance. He says, know what you're getting into before you buy.
If you feel a need to get into a bird for one reason or another, I would start with something like a cockatiel, which is a medium to small parrot that lives, 10 or 15 years, not 50 years or 60 years like a macaw. So you don't have to put it in your will, typically. And it's just as loving as a larger parrot, and they're all bred in captivity. So I would stick to cockatiels unless you have some real need to get into bigger parrots.
Many people inadvertently contribute to the depletion of endangered species when they buy wilderness products. Susan Lieberman from the Fish and Wildlife Service says there are few things worse than returning from an overseas vacation, only to discover that you've broken the law by purchasing something illegal. She has some tips to avoid this.
Most important thing is to be an informed consumer. Before, if someone is really in the market for something like that, we'd be glad to send them information before they go. They can also contact the government of the country that they're in to be sure something is legal. That's a good question, because often people will be in the marketplace, let's say in the Caribbean, and they may want to purchase sea turtles, which are completely illegal to import into the U.S. and to export from those countries. But someone on the street in a shop will say, oh, don't worry, it's okay, it's illegal, it's fine, you can get it in. But if they bring it in the U.S., they're smuggling, because the sea turtles are an endangered and protected species. So I'd say the most important thing is to, when in doubt, don't.
Other dangers in trading species include introduced species becoming pests. Poison ivy is now present in Europe because early settlers brought the plant back from North America as an ornamental plant. Keeping problems like this in check is particularly difficult, since the Fish and Wildlife Service has only about 200 officers throughout the country who must do everything from certifying a shipment of lizard skin shoes to investigating illegal shipping of elephants, which makes it all the more important that consumers be aware of the impact they are placing on the environment when they purchase anything that comes from the wild. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
You're listening to The Environment Show. You can write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. That's 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206. On June 27, Molly Beatty died of brain cancer at the age of 49. 3 weeks earlier, she had resigned from her position as the director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. As a guest on the Environment Show in May, she talked about how difficult it was to protect endangered species when the program had been put on hold during the congressional budget battles. During her tenure as director, 15 new wildlife refuges were created. She was a pioneer in the development of habitat conservation plans, separate agreements with individual landowners to protect habitat for endangered species. 140 were completed during her tenure. She's remembered by a friend, Roger Schlickhausen, president of the Defenders of Wildlife.
With the tragic premature death of Molly Beatty, environmentalists across the country have lost a great friend and ally. When she was named by President Clinton to be director of the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, there was some opposition from within Congress. She would be, after all, both the first woman and the first forester to head Fish and Wildlife. But like so many things Congress has done lately, its opposition was stupid. All of us acquainted with Molly knew she would be a great director and a true champion for wildlife, and she never disappointed us. As the primary official charged with implementing the Endangered Species Act and protecting the national wildlife refuges, Molly Beatty experienced more political pressure in 3 years than the rest of us see in a lifetime. But even when that pressure was the heaviest, and whether it came from an opposition Republican Congress or from within the Clinton administration, She never failed to make good stewardship of the nation's wildlife her top priority. I will never forget Molly showing up at an environmentalist press conference just after leaving the hospital following one of her brain tumor operations, or the television image of Molly worrying aloud about the survival of endangered species while lying in her own deathbed. But my favorite personal memory of Molly will always be of her in Yellowstone National Park just 2 months ago, rubbing cold water on the belly of a wild wolf to cool her down so we could transport her to another site for release. Rubbing and smiling broadly in spite of the cold wind and rain in her face, Molly said, "Any day I can touch a wild wolf is a good day." Molly was a true disciple of the great American conservationist, Aldo Leopold. And whenever and wherever she spoke in public, she always had her well-worn copy of Leopold's Sand County Almanac in hand to provide just the right quote to emphasize a point she wanted to make. As part of my own personal tribute to Molly, I reread Sand County Almanac this past weekend. Its first sentence says, "There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot." How very fortunate for all of us who care about protecting living nature that Molly Beatty was one who could not. Whatever success environmentalists ultimately achieve in the crucial fight to protect endangered species and conserve our precious but rapidly disappearing biodiversity will be due in part to the incredible spirit, courage, and accomplishments of Molly Beatty.
Roger Schlickhuysen is president of the Defenders of Wildlife. Listening to The Environment Show, and I'm Peter Burley. Still ahead, a lot of lumber these days is labeled environmentally friendly. We'll tell you which labels to trust and which ones to stay away from. 98-year-old Hazel Wolf is the senior activist in the environmental movement. We'll speak with her about what it means to be an effective advocate. And we ski on molten lava in New Zealand. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. A major international effort is now underway by some conservation organizations to develop a seal of approval for wood products that would tell the purchaser that the wood comes from a sustainably managed forest. The idea is that if people bought wood from sustainably managed forests and stayed away from the rest, market forces would work to save our forests rather than destroy them. The first hurdle is to define what sustainable forest really is. Richard Donovan, director of the Smart Wood Program at the Rainforest Alliance, gives the definition that his group is using.
Environmentally sustainable logging is logging which takes into consideration from the very beginning conserving the forest from a long-term perspective, protecting habitat for wildlife, minimizing erosion, protecting rivers and streams, and thinking over the long term, how is that forest best going to be protected to protect environmental values that most consumers are interested in. In practice, in most cases, what it means is doing harvesting very carefully and very well planned.
Sustainable forestry also recognizes that in many parts of the world, people live and work in the forest and have done so for generations. So a well-managed forest is a place that provides for the people as well as the wildlife that inhabit it. This is a particular concern to Leticia Merino, an anthropologist at the Mexican National University who is also a member of the Mexican Civil Council for Sustainable Silviculture.
Mexican forests are forests that are inhabited, heavily inhabited by people. Around 18 million people live in temperate and tropical forests from the country. Most of them are Indians, whose living conditions are some of the lowest in the country. So, I mean, if we want to build a strategy for that makes possible the survival, the permanence of the forest, these two things have to be taken into account.
A challenge facing nonprofit organizations working on wood product certification is that the lumber companies are developing their own certification system, which the environmentalists distrust. Chris Hatch is the campaign coordinator of the Rainforest Action Network.
There are industry-driven, logging industry-driven labels, which basically the logging industry wants to put a green stamp on its products in order to satisfy consumers that what they're buying is sustainable. And then there is the other camp of labels, which are third-party certification. That is to say that non-governmental organizations, foresters, some coalition of groups have set up an independent body that looks at the industry's operations and decides if they're sustainable. The most important in that second camp is a group called the Forest Stewardship Council. And the Forest Stewardship Council goes out and certifies certifiers, in fact. So in every region of the world, eventually, there will be a group certified by the Forest Stewardship Council using the Forest Stewardship Council logo and stamping that onto products that they deem to be environmentally responsible.
Can you get certified sustainable lumber in the marketplace today? Richard Donovan comments.
Now it's getting easier. You're going to be able to go to stores like Smith and Hawken. In some Home Depot stores you'll find it. You're going to be able to find this in most of your local lumber yards and home centers that will have products that have been certified independently by Forest Stewardship Council-endorsed certifiers.
Donovan says certified products are being made in 25 countries. He will not buy wood for Burma, now known as Myanmar, because in that country, certification is not allowed. This is a program which will grow if sellers of wood products know there is pressure from the marketplace.
The first thing that anyone who's interested in this field and wants to see it develop should do, I think, is go to your local lumber yard and ask them why they're not carrying certified products, because there are certified products on the market, and there's trouble right now matching consumers to suppliers. So if the lumber yards know that the demand is out there, they'll start stocking it. Home Depot is one company that is in the vanguard of this effort. They stock in their stores certified products from a variety of U.S. operations.
Chris Hatch is the campaign coordinator for the Rainforest Action Network. The environmental movement in America is full of persuasive people. One citizen activist who has a longer perspective than any other person in the movement is Hazel Wolf of Seattle, Washington. Hazel is 98 years old and spoke to me after she arrived on the East Coast on her way to the National Audubon Society's convention in Washington, D.C. We discussed the techniques she has used to persuade others to become active in campaigns to improve the environment. She avoids confrontation.
Well, you have to find something in common. You have to find a point where you agree to start from there. So you just have to work your way around till you find it. Because you can't talk unless you have some point of agreement.
In addition to talking with and persuading those with whom she differs, forming and participating in groups that advocate change has been a hallmark of her career as an activist. Hazel was a member of the Communist Party in the 30s. In the latter part of May of this year, she joined a picket line in Seattle with some of the strikers who were objecting to the outsourcing of jobs by the Boeing aircraft company in her hometown of Seattle. There are a large number of separate Audubon chapters in the state of Washington, and Hazel has formed all but a few. She's optimistic about what she has accomplished.
I think I've formed about 23 of them, maybe 21.
And I believe that's out of a total of about 26.
Yes.
So you are the Audubon founder of the Great Northwest.
The midwife.
The midwife.
No, I didn't found them. I got the people together.
And they did it.
And they did it, that's right.
What do you think, what kind of progress are we making in terms of increasing people's awareness and getting better environmental policy? As you look back over time, are we making progress? How do you think it's going?
Oh, we made a tremendous lot of progress. Most all of our environmental laws have been enacted in the last 20 years. Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, Endangered Species, Forest Sustainable Management of Forests, zoning, all of that legislation on different political levels has come about in the last 20 years. which this Congress that's in power now are trying to wipe out.
Are they going to succeed?
No, they're not going to succeed.
Persistence, as well as organizing, is an important element of her success. I asked her what strategy she used in the numerous campaigns she had been involved in to get better environmental legislation through the United States Congress.
The strategy is endless pressure, endlessly applied. And that's the way to go.
Perhaps Hazel's most impressive attribute is the attitude she conveys to all who know her.
Are you optimistic about the future as an environmentalist?
Oh, very much.
And tell us why, because there are so many people that say, oh, the world's coming to an end, we're polluting ourselves to death, and we're overpopulating ourselves to death, there is no hope. I know you have a different view. Why are you optimistic, and why should everybody else be optimistic?
Well, for one reason, it's more fun. Who wants to go around?
That is true.
Well, it's more fun way to live. But I think it's inherent in the human species. I don't think that any species has ever knowingly destroyed its habitat. And why should the humans be an exception to that if they know what's going on?
Hazel Wolf is an environmental activist from Seattle, Washington, who brings us insights gained in 98 years of experience. And now it's time for the Earth calendar. Right now, it's winter in New Zealand, and ballistic bombs are raining down from the sky. Lava, ash, and gas are being belched from the innards of the Earth, and mud flows threaten wildlife and humans alike. This is all due to Mount Rapehu, a 9,500-foot volcano on the North Island of New Zealand. Dr. Harry Keyes is a scientist with the Department of Conservation there.
The volcano seems to be quietening down again. From the biggest eruption was on Monday morning, and then there was another big one Monday night. That's a week ago, and since that time, the eruptions have been getting smaller, and the ash emission has been getting less, although ballistic bombs have been coming out.
The worst damage of this eruption came about 8 months ago when the volcano blew and explosively emptied a lake in the crater. All that water mixed up with mud and ash and raced down the mountain, causing extensive damage. In 1953, similar mud flows caused the worst volcanic disaster in New Zealand's history. Just before a train was to cross a ravine, a mud flow wiped out the bridge and 151 people plunged to their deaths. But has that scared New Zealanders away from Rapehu? Not at all. They've decided to ski on it.
But it's got two large ski fields on it and a third smaller one. And those two large ski fields were affected significantly last year. The mud flow that came down actually came down through part of one ski field. And it was very lucky that the skiing had closed for the day. So on a peak day, there might be several, 7,000, 8,000, 10,000 people. 8,000 people. On average day, on a very good day, there could be 8,000 people skiing on Rapehu. And on an active volcano, within, say, 5 kilometres of the crater, that's pretty unusual. We don't know of any other place in the world where that happens.
Environmentally, the biggest threats are to rare blue ducks and migrating trout. Mud flows have clogged up rivers and lakes, cutting back on habitat. About 5 to 10% of the deer around the mountain have died, and hydropower has been interrupted. But Keyes says Rapehu has been erupting for thousands of years, and we should respect it, the same way native New Zealanders do. The Maori.
The mountains are regarded as ancestor figures, and the peaks of Rapehu and Narahoe and Pongarito, which are the other two volcanoes, are sacred, a tapu, wahi tapu. The crater lake in Rapehu was actually a burial ground for Maoris before the Europeans arrived. And there are stories about the volcanoes having arguments about over female volcanoes, the male volcanoes arguing about female volcanoes. Some interesting stories there.
And so when you consider your next skiing vacation, perhaps you should add a little spice, or should I say ash, to it. But just don't mess with Rapehu's girlfriend. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burley. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-323-9262 and ask for program number 340. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer, Stephanie Goichman provided additional production support, and Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.